Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lots and lots of attention gets paid to helping students navigate what comes after their formal education. What kind of jobs, what kind of careers should they look for? But on today's show, we talked to one writer who wonders if we're doing a disservice to our kids by steering them into jobs that are available right now, ones that might not be available in the future. And engineering students at the University of Michigan are getting real-world experience by designing apps and video games that help autistic children. But first, easing trade restrictions with foreign nations. On the surface, it sounds like that could present new opportunities and more business for American companies like the Detroit Three automakers. But is there a deeper danger to American jobs in these overseas trade agreements? Michigan Democratic Congressman Gary Peters is speaking out, sharing his deep concerns about ongoing negotiations about a new multilateral trade agreement. It's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. Congressman Peters believes that letting Japan into the Trans-Pacific Partnership is courting real danger for U.S. auto companies. Representative Gary Peters joins us now from right here in Michigan. Welcome back to Stateside, Congressman.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Good to have you with us. I have to say, before we dig into your concerns over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, I have to point out there are some pretty prominent headlines today concerning you and the U.S. Senate seat that will be open in 2014 in Michigan because of Senator Carl Levin's retirement. What might we expect to hear from you tomorrow?
Well, first off, let me just say that with Carl's retirement, it's a real loss for us. You know, he's been just an incredible public servant. Of course, he continues to serve this year and next year throughout his term, but certainly, Carl has been an incredible advocate for us here in Michigan, and he will be missed in Washington, D.C. In terms of what some of the headlines, you know, I've been thinking very seriously about this race. Certainly, I've been encouraged by friends and supporters across the state have been encouraging me to take a look at running for the U.S. Senate, and something that my family and I have been thinking a great deal about. And we will be making an announcement soon as to what our decision is.
And then perhaps we will be talking with you again on Stateside about that.
Well, I would certainly welcome the opportunity. Anytime you'd like me to be on your program, it's really my pleasure.
All right, let's shift gears now, and we're going to talk trade. Exactly what is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and why does the Obama administration think it's worth the U.S. becoming a part of this agreement?
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a number of Asian basin countries coming together and looking at free trade agreements between them and increase trade. And certainly the president has been focused on increasing exports as a key part of economic development for our country. And I certainly support that we need to increase our exports made here in America by American workers and then shipped overseas as part of the trade process. But a key element of any kind of trade agreement, in my mind, is that it has to be fair. The rules have to be fair for all of the participants. And there's certainly concern with Japan coming into the negotiations on this agreement, opening up a number of markets to them. At the same time, Japan continues to be perhaps the most closed market in the world. It is very difficult for U.S. companies to export into Japan, particularly the auto sector. And for those of us here in Michigan, automobiles is a big deal. And the Japanese have consistently had closed markets, having non-tariff restrictions that make it very difficult for us to sell our automobiles into Japan. Also, they have engaged in currency manipulation of their currency in order to devalue it, which puts our products at a competitive disadvantage and puts their products at a competitive advantage coming here into the United States.
So Japan eliminated those tariffs back in the 1970s, but as you point out in your piece that you had recently in the Detroit News, they are using other ways of keeping our cars out, right? As you say, currency manipulation. What else are they doing?
Well, and then other sorts of regulations and requirements that make it very difficult for a foreign exporter to bring in products. So it gives an advantage for their domestic. So certainly every country has regulations, whether it's safety, environmental regulations that are put in place. But sometimes those regulations have less to do with the safety of a car and more to do with the difficulty that a foreign manufacturer may have to adapt their products to be sold in that market. And that's when it becomes really a non-tariff barrier, designed as a barrier for products. Gets around some of the WTO regulations and rules. And certainly currency manipulation is the other thing that you mentioned, which devalues their currency, makes their products more attractive overseas, and makes ours more expensive. But it's not the free-floating currency. It's direct actions by the governments, which We certainly think are wrong. It's not a fair playing field. It's not just Japan. Of course, China also engages in those activities, and we need to be much stricter in our trade enforcement. And my concern, as well as the concern of many of my colleagues in Congress, as well as the concern of both our U.S. auto manufacturers here in the Michigan area, as well as UAW, is that Japan, before they are allowed into the TPP, if we were to allow that to happen, they should show some good faith by opening their markets to the same extent as the United States has opened our markets to their products.
Do you feel, Congressman, that the other countries who could be possible players in the TPP, there's Mexico, Australia, Chile, Vietnam, for instance, is the playing field more even with those countries, and do we have a fair shot there?
Yes, we do. Yeah, there's no question, and I have no, we have not expressed any opposition to the entering into negotiations with those countries, but it seems to me that if you're dealing with a country that has had a persistent pattern of engaging in activities which effectively close their markets to our products, while at the same token, we are opening, we've opened our markets. And I had an issue with the Japanese recently when, you may recall, during the auto crisis, we passed the Cash for Clunkers program, which was helpful to stimulate auto demand, which is critical to get our companies back on their feet. And we specifically opened that up to manufacturers of any product. We were told that it would be a violation of the World Trade Organization if those incentives were not also for foreign-made cars. We did that, as well as the Germans did before us. And yet when the Japanese also were faced in the situation with their domestic auto industry in the same difficulties that we were having, they passed a Cash for Clunkers, but specifically made it next to impossible for any American automobile to qualify for their Cash for Clunkers type incentives. That's a clear example where the rules seem to be different for the Japanese. We're saying, let's make sure it's fair and the rules are the same. We'll compete with you, but the rules have to be fair and even.
I'm speaking with Michigan Democratic Congressman Gary Peters, whose op-ed piece in the Detroit News expresses his deep concerns about ongoing negotiations on a new multilateral trade agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And in your piece, Congressman, you compare the effects of Japan's possible entrance into the TPP with the hit Michigan took during the NAFTA period, that 1994 to 2012, because during those 18 years, Michigan lost more than 263,000 jobs. That was a 33% decrease in manufacturing jobs. Do you have the same fears if Japan is allowed into the TPP?
We do. We think that there will be a hit, particularly in the auto sector. You can argue about different sectors that are not going to necessarily have that kind of hit, but there's certainly a very strong concern that has been expressed to me as well in no uncertain terms from our domestic auto manufacturers, that they are very concerned that this unlevel playing field will mean that they will lose some of their competitiveness as a result of unfair rules, and it will likely cost jobs.
Well, at the conclusion of your piece in the Detroit News, you suggest that full funding of the Interagency Trade Enforcement Center, ITEC, would be a step toward equaling and leveling the playing field in the TPP negotiations. Can you tell us more about this agency? What does it do?
Well, the agency is charged with enforcing the trade rules. With most of the trade agreements, there are very specific rules, and hopefully to make the rules fair. But as you know, rules are only good if they're actually enforced, if there's actually a watchdog looking to see what is happening and whether or not those rules are being applied the way they should be. So the agency is our enforcement arm. It's certainly been the past practice, particularly in the previous presidential administration under President Bush, that rules were simply not enforced. It is very important for us to beef that up. Certainly the Obama administration has been much more aggressive in going after the dumping of products in the United States, which forces out particularly smaller manufacturers or smaller companies in our country. But we need to make sure that that agency is fully funded. And bottom line, it means protecting American jobs. And again, it's protecting American jobs by just making a level playing field and making sure that everybody who signs an agreement is actually abiding by that agreement.
Is there some issue? Is the ITEC not being fully funded now, or do you want to preserve that? Has it taken a hit with sequester cuts? I mean, when you talk about full funding, does it not have that right now?
It doesn't. Certainly sequester cuts go across the board, but it can be a much more robust operation than it is. And I'm a strong believer when you enforce these trade laws as well, the investment you make in that enforcement is more than paid off in the fact that it keeps jobs in America, keeps people working, and those are folks who pay taxes as well. So it, it self-funds itself by making sure that the rules are fair and applied equally to all countries that are a party to those agreements.
Michigan Congressman Gary Peters expressing concerns about allowing Japan into the Trans-Pacific Partnership if some things don't change. And Congressman, thanks for talking with us today. And perhaps we will be talking with you again on Stateside very, very soon about another topic.
Well, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for having me on.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, dads and moms, all those hours your son or daughter spent wallowing in video games or trying out all of those apps, it's paying off in ways you may never have imagined. At least that's what we can say to the moms and dads of University of Michigan students enrolled in computer science and engineering, specifically Dr. David Chesney's sections of ENGR 100 and EECS 481. Under Dr. Chesney's guidance, students in these courses have been developing games and apps that help people with disabilities. Call it gaming for the greater good. And Dr. David Chesney joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So where and how did you get the inspiration to take the students' energy and their brain power and channel it into such a positive goal?
Well, we always tried to build computer games for the social good in these classes. And then very recently, within the past 2 or 3 years, we tried directing them towards specific disabilities, such as cerebral palsy or autism.
How did that happen? Where did the light go on where you were thinking, did you meet someone or did you cross paths with someone that kind of opened your eyes to the need?
So about 7 or 8 years ago, I took a tour in our local school district with folks, specifically Chris Tonge, who does some work with Livingston Educational Services Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And they put together assistive technology devices for kids with physical disabilities. And so I took the tour with her, and I thought, this is pretty interesting, but I think we could do better. You know, I think there's perhaps new technology that we could develop here at the University of Michigan.
So give me some idea. What kinds of apps and games have they been able to develop that actually have real-world use?
Well, one of the ones that we're the most excited about currently is, I don't know if you know the Microsoft Kinect sensor.
Okay.
But it's a camera.
For those of us who don't, explain what that is.
All right. So it's a camera that faces towards the player, and it tracks skeletal motion. So basically, as the person moves, then the character that's on the screen, the avatar that's on the screen, also has those motions.
Okay.
And we thought that that would be a great type of sensor to use to track the motion of somebody with a disability. So basically, you know, if you want someone to have some kind of exercise, you know, exercising their right arm or their left arm or some type of motion, then the person can actually do that motion and watch the player, the character on the screen, do it back at them.
And the benefit for the patient would be?
The benefit for the patient, I mean, it varies.
Yes.
I mean, it can be just physical rehabilitation that, you know, you need to exercise your right arm more. We're building games right now that have cooperative play, that two people are playing them, and so somebody needs to step on top of this magic pad that opens a door so that the other player can walk through. So collaborative play, facial feature as an eye tracking so that the person mm-hmm. who's actually playing is maintaining eye contact with the avatar that's on the screen, different things.
Now, I saw somewhere that your senior level kids, the first year, this was in Engineering 481, that they came up with an iPad app?
Yes. There was a group of a half a dozen students that came up with an iPad app for people with cerebral palsy to be able to receive and send texts and emails. Basically, the whole iPad screen functions as a big Staples Easy Button, where anywhere you touch on the screen, you can create emails. And it's absolutely fascinating. I actually saw a video of the tool being used by somebody with cerebral palsy, and the only fine motor skills that this person had was in their right foot. So they actually had set the iPad on the floor, and they were tapping the iPad with their big toe in order to create emails.
I've got to imagine, David, that you have students who are, you were saying it was remarkable to see someone with a disability being able to use something that these kids have been working on in the classroom. What is that like for the students to see the realization of all that work actually helping someone?
Oh, it's tremendous, and I think it really brings it to life. You know, for a lot of the classes that we have, they're technologically challenging, you know, to come up with new products.
Yes.
But to actually see them being used by somebody is just tremendous. And it's really moving to see the students actually try the products and to play the products with these kids, with these special needs kids. We had a group of kids with autism spectrum disorder come into the computer science building to actually play the games one night. And that was probably the single most, you know, moving example of our students working with these kids that I've seen. They just had a tremendous time. And it's interesting, the kids with autism, they were, to a person, they were just absolutely delightful and polite. And they didn't want to give any negative feedback to the games, right? I mean, when you're developing a game, you want the feedback so that you can make the game better and better.
Yes, pro and con.
Pro and con, right? And these kids were like, oh, that is just such a fun game. We just so enjoyed playing it. It's like, yeah, but what can we improve? Oh, nothing. It's just wonderful. And so it was really cool. It was really interesting. It was just an excellent experience for my students.
Dr. David Chesney is professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Michigan, developer of the Gaming for the Greater Good courses. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to an artistic vision that takes photography, poetry, and music and turns it all into a stunning collection of poems set to music. The photographs are by Yako Vasilev of Bulgaria. The book of poems is called 10 Songs from Bulgaria. It's by Grand Rapids poet and writer Linda Nemec Foster. And the CD is Cry of Freedom from Laszlo Slomovitz of Ann Arbor. Before we talk with Linda and Laszlo, let's take a listen.
Time that could be my time. Child that could be my daughter. Child that could be my child. Child that could be my daughter. You're like an unspoken fairy tale. The clear blue sky, if it had a human face.
That's Child with Dove, the poetry of Linda Nemec Foster and the voice and the music of Laszlo Slomovitz. And again, inspired by a photograph, this one of a little girl in Bulgaria taken by Yako Vasilev. Linda and Laszlo, join us in the studio today. Welcome to both of you to Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Linda, start by telling us about the photographer and these photographs from Bulgaria that inspired you to write your poems, 10 Songs from Bulgaria. What about them particularly inspired you?
Well, they're very moving and haunting. It's from a portfolio that was published in Harper's Magazine. I believe it was in 2005 or 06. And a very good friend of mine, Therese Becker, showed the photographs to me, knowing that I'd be inspired to write something. And they're really beautiful, haunting visual witnesses to the marginalized and impoverished people in Eastern Europe, be they homeless, amputees, war veterans, orphans, you know, people in psychiatric facilities. It was quite a moving testament to their dignity and the struggle that they have every day.
Were these photographs from the 1980s, the 1990s?
I think they're pretty contemporary. Okay. I would say 90s.
So you saw those. You were inspired out of that whole array of photographs to write these 10 poems, 10 songs from Bulgaria.
Yes. And each poem is really inspired by each one of those photographs. And I took the title, the title that Yako had given each portrait, that's the title I gave for the poem.
And then how did they become these splendid, beautiful songs by Laszlo Slomovitz?
Well, that is quite a journey, and it really is a testament to the wonderful power of art. This rarely happens in this world. When you write a poem, write a story, write a song, it goes out in the world.
Yes.
You have no idea where it lands, where it turns up, who reads it, who listens to it. But I gave a poetry reading in the Upper Peninsula in 2011 in Nagani, in a little library, and another poet was there with me, Jennifer Bird, who saw the book, saw the poems and said, I want to buy this chapbook for myself and I want to buy a copy for my friend who's a musician who I had never met before.
So take it away, Laszlo.
So Jennifer brought the book back to me and I took one look at it and the title instantly intrigued me, 10 Songs. Of course, they were poems, but they have a very tight, similar structure, each of them 10 lines. I just started engaging with them. And in a very short time, three or four songs started popping up out of those poems. And I contacted Linda and I said, I love these poems, and I'm setting them to music, but I want to ask your permission. Is this okay?
And you are absolutely.
Hallelujah.
And what was really wonderful when Laz emailed me, he said, you know, I have a little CD I could burn for you. Only 4 are completed. And keep in mind, it's just me and my guitar in my living room. It's nothing fancy. You know, it's not in a studio. It's not with other musicians. Well, Cynthia, I heard these songs and I was blown away because he got the spirit, not only of the words, but he got the spirit of these people. And he hadn't seen the photographs yet.
So you were going off of her poems.
Totally.
What was it that you felt in reading those poems that you wanted to express in your songs, Laszlo?
I think what Linda said about relating to people who very often we don't want to see or we don't know how to relate to. Mm. And that's something that just really drew me in, that Linda had really looked at these in the same way that the photographer had, and I wanted to respond to it musically.
So yes. From photography to poetry to beautifully done songs. I'd like, Linda, to ask you to read your poem, The Dance of Zlatio Zlatev, Ex-Pilot. And then we're going to hear an excerpt from Laszlo's song.
If he could fly, he would. Not in a Soviet MiG fighter jet, but in the calm buoyancy of his own levitation. Zlatio, the patron saint of pilots. Zlatio, more profound than any mystic from Assisi. Zlatio, never forgetting heaven as he looks at his feet and the pattern they make in the earth's dust.
If he could fly, he would. If he could fly, he would. Not in a Soviet MiG fighter jet, but in the calm buoyancy of his own levitation.
Vasilev's photographs from Bulgaria do show a very, very hard existence. Linda, you have Polish roots. You've traveled there often. Laszlo, you were born in Hungary. And I'm wondering, have you personally seen these kinds of images and this kind of grinding poverty firsthand in your travels or in your life in Hungary before you came here?
Actually, not when I was growing up. I was born in Budapest, and my parents kind of shielded us from things like that. A few years ago, my brother and I went back to Hungary and visited Budapest. And this time, I saw the sights that I was shown when I was growing up, but also the homelessness in the subways and so on. In other words, it's the same all over the world, unfortunately.
What can you describe to us of the personalities and the traits of the people of the Eastern European nations, the people we see in these photos?
Well, you know, I lived with these photos for over a year before I started composing and writing the poems. And I've been to Poland, I think, 6 or 7 times to visit my family. I still have a lot of cousins who live there in southern Poland and Krakow. And what I see when I look at the faces of these people in the photographs is just not only resilience, but almost a kind of joy in their lives. For instance, Zlatio, the poem that I just read, is this wonderful picture of a man who looks like he is dancing and he doesn't care what anyone thinks of him. So it's that resilience, it's that, you know, common humanity, yet there is this pure essence of life that is emanating from these people.
I think I responded musically because, of course, growing up in that culture, the musics of all of those regions have a shared tonality. And it's very often a melancholy, sad kind of minor feel to the music. And so that went very naturally with the poems. But in the same way, I was also looking for that joy, that strength that they had. Mm-hmm. And the Zlatio Zlatev, there's a range of styles that I used in the poems. But that one, that just felt like a blues. And of course, the blues comes from that same suffering and yet joy in this culture
that we've seen.
And so
it speaks around the world, doesn't it?
That's right.
It really does. How do you present your poems and songs in your shows? What do you do together?
Well, we just had our world premiere a couple of weeks ago in Grand Rapids at Schuller Books, and this is how we do it. I will read a poem without any music and accompaniment. I will read a poem, and then Laz will, you know, do his rendition of it with his guitar.
What I'd like is to have us go out, and actually what I'd like you to do, if you will, is, Linda, is read for us "A Man is a Man When a Man is on the Road," and then we want to hear Laz singing that. So let's hear that.
Thank you. This is the silent music of the road, uneven cobblestones and the long journey, with an accordion strapped to my back. The black bellows open and inch down like some thick Balkan caterpillar, fat slug of Eastern Europe. Not me. I keep walking. To where, you might ask? For what? I don't know the answers. I'm only amused that you would notice me at all. You, with your world as tangible as fog.
A man is a man when a man is on the road. A man is a man when a man is on the road. This is the silent music of the road. Uneven cobblestones and the long journey, with an accordion strapped to my back. The black bellows open an inch down like some thick Balkan caterpillar, fat slug of Eastern Europe. Not me. Not me, I keep walking. A man is a man when a man is on the road. A man is a man when a man is on the road. A man is a man when a man is on the road. A man is a man when a man is on the road.
Composer-singer Laszlo Slomovitz and poet Linda Nemec Foster. They will be performing tonight at 7 o'clock at Nicola's Bookstore in Ann Arbor. We have put links to the photos, the poems, and the songs on our stateside page at michiganradio.org, so you can plunge in and discover this all for yourself. And I have to say, I can't remember when I've been more struck by a CD, a voice, a word, and the message of what you've put together. So thank you so much for sharing that with all of us.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, here's a question for you to consider. Are we doing the students of Michigan a disservice as we steer them to jobs that businesses are demanding right now in 2013? It's certainly a big, big push for Governor Rick Snyder. But columnist Rick Haglund, writing in this week's MLive.com, has some misgivings about the growing push to match courses with what business wants in Michigan grads. Rick, one might think the governor's on the right track. Why do you think this approach could backfire in the long run?
Well, I think there's always a danger of educating kids or training them for too narrow of an occupation. We've been through this before. It seems like when the economy starts to improve, businesses say, well, we need, you know, more tool and die makers, we need more engineers, we need more software developers, and they go to the state and say, it's your responsibility to give us these people that we need right now. But there's really a debate as to whether or not that's really the responsibility of the state's education system. And also, we live in an economy or in a world where things change very rapidly. And if you have some kid who's in the fourth grade who thinks he wants to do a certain occupation, I mean, who knows whether that job will still be there when he graduates a decade or so later.
And actually, as you say this, when you think of some of those jobs you just mentioned, tool and die makers and engineers, we saw those folks getting thrown overboard as the auto industry tanked during the Great Recession.
That's right. That's right. And this happened, you know, back in the 90s. Governor Engler did something similar with his Department of Career Development. And it's not necessarily a terrible thing. In fact, I think it's a good thing to basically give students awareness of what's going on in the economy and give them some options, but to basically try to steer them into something that's there today that might not be there tomorrow is, I think, a dangerous thing.
Well, it's interesting. Here we're having this conversation as the state legislature is chewing over whether or not to cut Algebra 2 and the foreign language requirements from high school graduation standards. And those who want to do that will say, we're not saying don't take them. We're saying they should have a choice. And if somebody wants to take something more technically oriented, they should have that choice. So I got the sense they don't feel they're steering. They're saying they want to open options up.
Well, that's true. On the other hand, the educators, and I think even Mike Flanagan, the state school superintendent, has said this, is that kids that even go into technical, what we used to call vocational type things, they still need those math skills, and they're still capable of meeting those standards. And who knows, they may certainly come in handy years down the road, long after the students have graduated.
So what do you think we need to do to lessen the danger that, the last thing you want is kids going through school now to risk becoming irrelevant in tomorrow's economy? So what do you think needs to be done instead?
Well, I think you continue to concentrate on the core education. Another thing that Larry Good told me, Larry Good is a workforce development expert out of Ann Arbor, and he said that, one of the things that we really need to do is to sit down and kind of figure out where we think jobs are going or the process of getting a job. Larry was saying that with a more technical world, we're getting to a point where you need that college degree, whether it's a two-year or a four-year degree, but you may also need specific certifications for different types of computer software, what have you. When I was starting out in journalism, we were using typewriters, I hate to say.
I'm with you. IBM Selectric 2 with an Orator font.
Right. And now if you look at a job description for a journalist, somebody that's hiring a journalist, you will see requirements that you have proficiency in all sorts of different kinds of software programs and, video editing and that sort of thing. So in many careers, we're going to need this broad basic education, but we're also going to need to add credentials to that. And what Larry is telling me is our system really isn't set up for that right now, that we really need to have a conversation about how we get there.
And that's what you're endeavoring to do here. And as you point out at the close of your piece on MLive, you made an interesting observation about Governor Snyder that I'd like you to share with everyone.
Well, Governor Snyder has 3 degrees from the University of Michigan, and he prepared himself very well for different changes that were going to be inevitable in his career. So he has had a lot of flexibility through his education to succeed in a variety of different careers.
Rick Hagland, his piece in MLive is called Steering Students to Today's Jobs May Do Them a Great Disservice. Rick, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you, Cindy.
A couple of recent columns in Bridge magazine caught our eye. We wanted to bring the writers together to share their thoughts with you. The subject is exercising our right to vote. From coast to coast, way too many Americans sit on the sidelines when it comes to Election Day. And you look at the city of Detroit with its state-appointed emergency manager running things. And Detroiter Karen Dumas did that, and she believes that Detroiters have paid a price for what she calls a lack of diligence. And she spelled out her thoughts in a recent Bridge column. And Bridge staff writer Nancy Derringer reports on a group in Detroit trying to make voting cool, especially among the young people starting to move into the city. So we wanted to have a conversation with both of them about voting. Karen Dumas joins us from Detroit. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Cynthia. Thank you so much.
And Nancy Derringer is with us in the studio. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
So, Karen, I'd like to start with you. Just what pushed you to put out that piece saying Detroiters pay the price for their lack of diligence?
Well, I think it was the kind of uproar that people were expressing in terms of Kevin Orr being appointed and council not being diligent or responsive enough. And when you kind of look around, I'm wondering, where have all these people been along and throughout the process? You know, certainly there's a core group of people here in the city that work very hard to engage voters. But, you know, it's a process beyond going to the voting booth. You know, you have to remain informed, you have to remain engaged, and you have to hold your elected officials accountable. So it's not just when things start to slip away that you step up to the microphone and start to express your opinion or outrage.
So you're saying it's like critics of emergency manager Kevin Orr are complaining that democracy has been stolen away. Your view is, hey, we gave it away.
Well, not necessarily gave it away. I think we let it slip away. And it's not just about Kevin Orr. I mean, certainly I do think that there are some issues at the state level that, you know, but I think we made it convenient for them to do what they've done. And, you know, it's about council. It's about, you know, every elected official. And this isn't just, I don't think, unique to Detroit. I mean, certainly people vote for name recognition, you know, popularity. And at the end of the day, we end up with a less than maybe qualified, you know, representation.
And Nancy Derringer, you're like, amen, amen.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what she just said is absolutely true. And that's one of the things that is coming up with this Vote Detroit group, which is an arm of Publius, which is a voter education organization run by Vince Keenan. And that's the first thing that they talk about when this issue comes up is you really can't say that, you know, we've had our democracy taken away from us when so many people who live in Detroit, and particularly these younger newcomers, are sitting every election out because of financial reasons. And we got into that in an early article in Bridge, which is, you know, the major one is auto insurance.
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, if you live in the city of Detroit and register to vote there, sooner, because it's tied via motor voters, sooner or later your auto insurer is going to discover where you're living. And the fact remains that people who live within the city limits in Detroit can pay double, sometimes triple, what you would pay on the other side of 8 Mile Road. And that's just, you know, a lot of people find that. And we're talking thousands of dollars here. So a lot of people find that to be just a problem they don't need to have.
And it's robbing the city then of energetic young voters who would have something to contribute if they felt safe in doing so.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, 2013 is going to be a pivotal year for the city because of the new city charter will allow the city council to be elected by district for the first time in nearly a century. So there's a lot of good reasons to become an active, involved, voting citizen of Detroit. And that's what this Vote Detroit group is all about.
And I think that that's good, but we still have what I call legacy residents here that also need to be engaged. You know, and a lot of the issues that contribute to high insurance rate here in the city are contributed or created by people that don't live here. I mean, you have to remember a lot of crimes take place, and then the body or the car is dumped here, and Detroit gets saddlebagged with being a cesspool of crime, and we pay the rates for doing so. Now, that's not to say that we don't statistically have higher crime because of the high number of people here in the city, but that's something that also kind of it's a burden that we bear here in the city. So there's some people that are still here that need to be engaged in terms of the voting process. Just doing so for the newcomers is probably going to create an imbalance that we probably don't want to see down the road.
Yeah. More them and us.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Karen. I mean, this is not just about new young people.
So what does it take then to engage, especially, Karen, as you call them, the legacy voters? What's keeping them home, and what is it going to take to engage these voters?
Well, that's a good question, and I certainly wish I had the answer. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that the turn of events of late will serve as a reawakening, again, not just to vote, but to be engaged, actively engaged, and move beyond just election day. I'm not really sure. I know a lot of Detroiters are tired. Some of them feel hopeless because they've repeatedly had high expectations and been disappointed. So I'm not really sure. I'm hoping that, you know, we do have an emergency manager here, whether those, whoever wanted him here or not, but I'm hoping that if, in fact, the citizens can start to see some progress that they can hang their hats on, that maybe their confidence will be restored in the process.
That's a good point. You know, sometimes you have to kind of hit bottom before you can, you know, before that is reawakened in a voting population.
I'm speaking with Karen Dumas and Nancy Derringer, both of whom had pieces in recent editions of Bridge Magazine looking at voting and what happens if people don't stay diligent and involved with their government and perhaps pay a price in that way. And Also, Nancy's piece looked at a group called Vote Detroit, trying to make voting cool again in Detroit. And one of the things that you were told as you researched this piece that I thought was interesting, Nancy, is you can't be scoldy. You can't be schoolmarmish and try to shame people into voting, because that's just going to keep them home, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, it's you walk a very thin line there between telling people what Karen just brought up, which is, you know, one of the reasons that auto insurance is so high in the city is because people have not been engaged, and people have not been pushing back against this sort of thing. They just sidestep it by having their registration outside the city. And also, you know, it's almost like a civics lesson, but a civics lesson that kind of, you know, in their words, tries to make voting a little cooler than perhaps you might think. So, you know, the idea is you really cannot complain about conditions in the city if you are not participating in its civic life. I think Allison Krieger said, you know, we could all be at a reception at the MOCAD, you know, some super cool thing in downtown Detroit, and, you know, somebody clutches their chest and keels over. We would expect 911 to be there in a very brief interval. But if we haven't been supporting the city through not just, you know, our voting, but also living there and paying taxes and so forth, we really can't complain about that.
There should be engagement on an ongoing and regular basis. But, you know, I'm also thinking, too, that at some point, you know, residents will give, especially with the charter and the new election coming forth, that we can start to see some diversity in terms of representation. The complexion of our city is changing. You know, we have younger residents moving in. They're not all African-American as the city is traditionally looked upon as. You know, we have a strong Middle Eastern presence here as well as a Hispanic population. I'd like to see some of that representation, at least on our council. You know, we've got a couple crazy districts that I don't know how that's going to emerge. But, you know, I think that would also kind of create a feeling of inclusion and kind of get people to rally behind the things that affect and impact all of us.
Boy, wouldn't that be great if that actually happened?
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice.
Yes.
I mean, it should be, you know. I mean, I'd like to see some business acumen on the council. You know, I'd like to see somebody that brings something to the table, a degree of professionalism in another area outside of just earlier elected office.
You know, one of the things that came up over and over when I was doing my original reporting on this was people saying, well, you know, you really can't blame young people for not wanting to register in the city because, you know, they move often and they don't own property and they're this and they're that. And it's like, you know, we don't call it the we don't restrict voting to property owners. You know, we call it the right to vote, and it's really a responsibility as well. But it's not something that you do after you've settled down and are worried about schools and become more of what we call a stakeholder. I mean, it's really something that everybody who is over 18 should be doing, and should be doing with knowledge and education before they walk into the voting booth.
And it does exist. I actually, when Mike Duggan first started having those coffee meetings at homes, I went to one of the first ones because I just wanted to see who came and what was it like. I was completely blown away, impressed by the packed house of energetic young Detroiters. And as you say, Karen, the complexion is different. There were Latino, there were Arabic, there were African American, and there were white, and they were all there and they cared.
Yeah.
So
at the end of the day, we all want the same things. You know, I mean, I pay exorbitant insurance rates. I had to send my kids to private school. I mean, I don't have a street light on my block, but I'm in one of the neighborhoods that's looked upon as one of the better neighborhoods in the city. But we all want the same things. And I think that at some point, and some person will be able to, you know, initiate that conversation that we can all participate in.
Well, we will be watching that. In meantime, Vote Detroit is out there trying to make it cool to vote and just trying to, they're not looking for big numbers, are they? They're planting seeds?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, well, first of all, it's not really going to be very measurable.
Right.
And, you know, the city has no shortage of registered voters. The problem is because we're still seeing, you know, population exodus, and there's no easy way to, if people don't formally resign or you know, change your registration, it's difficult to track how many of those are what they call inactive. But at the same time, you know, they say it's as much an awareness campaign as anything else. And they want to, like you said, not shame, but motivate.
And actually, I have no doubt we could take this conversation and expand it beyond Detroit border to Michigan at large, as far as just firing up that sense of urgency and that sense of privilege of voting.
Yeah, I think so. Because so many of us drive in Michigan, I was told by Vince Keenan that we generally do have a pretty high voter registration mm-hmm. rate, but voter registration should not be confused with voter participation. And they're two different things. And that's what we want to see is not just registration, but also participation. Going out there, doing your research, and casting the most well-informed vote that you can.
And Karen, and the price for not doing that, in your view?
The price for not doing that is ending up with something that you don't want, whether it's a lack of city services, whether it's misplaced or uncommitted representation, or even, in the opinion of some, the lack of your voice being heard or respected.
Karen Dumas, former chief of communications for Detroit Mayor Dave Bing and a PR communications strategist. Her firm is called Images and Ideas Incorporated. Karen joined us from Detroit. And veteran reporter and Bridge staff writer Nancy Derringer joined us in the studio. Thank you so much to both of you. It was really a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah. Always, Cynthia. Thank you, guys. Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thanks for having me.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.